Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live. We are in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I continue to postdoc it up at the Weatherhead Center for International Affairs, where I'm actually in the middle of my course that I'm teaching on popular culture. And today we're going to talk to someone who has researched some popular culture things and visual representations and the meaning of those things. And she has written a new book that is launching next week.
It's actually out, but this is sort of a launch week because I'm doing an event at the Harvard Bookstore. Right. I'm an event at Harvard. So right. In my mind, this is the launch week.
Okay, so yeah, so the big official launch after the soft release maybe is coming up this week. It's Disaster Drawn, Visual Witness, Comics, and Documentary Form. And the voice you heard was that of Hilary Shute, a visiting professor in the English department here at Harvard, normally from the University of Chicago, and a Cambridge, Massachusetts native. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So this book, like you say, it's out, but really being launched this week. We should note it's a Harvard University book, the publisher. And you're looking at nonfiction representations of war through the 20th century. Obviously, your main interest is in comics. You've written two other books. You've edited a couple other books to make the rest of us feel really inadequate because you're not that far out of your PhD, and to have five books on your line is pretty impressive. But generally speaking, where does this interest in comics and the visual representations of drawing come from?
Mouse was the first graphic narrative that I got really fascinated by. I wasn't a fan of comics as a kid. I liked some comics. I read Garfield. I read Asterix. I read Tintin. I have two older sisters, so I read some of their cast-off underground comics, and I once discovered a whole moldering trunk full of horror comics belonging to some cousins. But I wasn't coming at it from a fan angle. And I actually read Mouse as a graduate student when I was getting my PhD in a contemporary literature course that had mostly historical fiction as part of the syllabus. And I became fascinated by it. That was 16 years ago, and I feel like I still haven't stopped thinking about Mouse and how come it works so well. So Mouse was really the inspirational text for me. The more I looked after I read it, the more I found that there were other stories like Mouse, maybe not the same in the particulars, but I discovered Joe Sacco's work, and I discovered other work that is about basically world historical conflict and trauma. So my guiding question was, why this medium for these kinds of stories?
It's interesting, though, because when we think of comics, we think of nerdy, mostly white guys at a comic book store, right? Sort of the Big Bang Theory crew in there. So you are obviously not a nerdy white guy. So coming at that, is there a gender dynamic to this that you're approaching it, or that maybe you're unique in the field as a woman approaching comics?
Well, right. I might not be a nerdy white guy. I guess I'm a nerdy white woman. there are a couple things. I think that I didn't come at comics with the kinds of assumptions that fans come at comics with. So I didn't have that fan background, which I think was really useful for me. And if I want to work in really broad strokes, I think today serious fan culture is much more diverse in terms of gender and sexuality than it ever has been before. But as you say, typically the sort of stereotype of the comic book fan is the nerdy white guy, as you said, or as some of my students would point out, oh, it's like the comic book guy character from The Simpsons, for example, right? So the sort of lording esoteric knowledge over you, collector, culture, obsessed, marginalized, chip on the shoulder, nerdy white guy. And I do think that the fact that I'm a woman and I don't have this fan background has earned me some skepticism in some pockets of comics culture. and I'll take it. Yeah. I don't mind at all. I think that's coupled with the fact that I've done a lot of field building within the academy relating to the academic study of comics. So A, I'm a woman. B, I don't have a fan background. And C, in the view of some, I'm bringing comics from a vital, popular, mass-oriented space into an elite, rarefied space. So I'd say that I've gotten some flack for that, too. And again, I'll take it. I feel like the more kinds of spaces that comics is studied in, the better. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to be the person helping to bring comics to the academy, whatever mm-hmm. those implications are.
And it's hard because when I've lectured the pop culture course that I've taught, in the 50s I talk about comics and the subversive nature of comics during the 50s as it relates to McCarthyism.
Do you talk about Mad? Idea. Magazine?
Yes. Mad yeah, comics. We talked about that, yeah. And also some of the more violent ones, these sort of the underground ones as well. Those are sort of the two extremes of satire and violence being represented. Yep. But I only talk about it in the 50s, and it's not extensive. And usually the reaction I get from students is that, because I set it all up as, you know, pop culture being very mainstream and economically viable, and yet comics, some of the ones I talk about, maybe not so much, and they question whether or not they belong in that course. So it's one of these dynamics that it seems as though it would be difficult to sort of beat into people how relevant these things are.
Yeah. I love that narrative that you were just sketching, actually, because I feel like at all points in its popular history and its sort of history being studied in the academy, there's something productively awkward about the place of comics. Like, it doesn't quite slot in as a form the way one might want it to, in a way that I find actually really inspiring. So, I mean, in the 50s, you were talking about horror comics, there was really, really kind of gross and weird, but really fascinating and powerful work being produced in the 50s in mainstream genre comic books. And it actually was an industry that got derailed not by lack of consumer interest, because these comics sold really well, but because of these Senate hearings mm-hmm. in the U.S. That led to a censorship code for comics that basically destroyed the above-ground comics mm-hmm. industry. So I think the consumers were into it.
Right, yeah. And once they become subversive, they get shut down, and that's why they're powerful too. Yeah. Is that they're commenting on things that in the 1950s Lucy wasn't.
Yeah,
right. So it gives expression to things that otherwise are not said, and at the same time, though, for some reason, I feel as though the general perception of comics is that they're not intellectual endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
That they're meant for a less intelligent audience. Is that something that you've come across too in the popular perception of comics?
I come across it all the time, sort of even in this day and age where there have been so many obviously sophisticated, literary, fascinating comics. So I feel like I'm always doing a sort of song and dance about comics to convince people that what you just said isn't actually the case. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if you look in the 50s, something like Mad Magazine was so sophisticated. Mad Comics, which was started in 1952, which later became Mad Magazine. And one of the ways I like to point this out to my students is that I feel that Mad basically created what today we would just call humor, like the fake news shows, you know, with Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart. This whole awareness of the medium and the conventions of the medium being part of the subject of the work was something pioneered by Harvey Kurtzman at Mad. And now it's just sort of everywhere, right? It's ubiquitous. It's what we call humor. It's kind of what we call news. But, I mean, Mad started that kind of deeply intelligent, also deeply formalist, also deeply hilarious satire. So it was for kids, kind of, but also for adults, too.
This book, though, you're looking at nonfiction comics.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, how do you define the two, because something that is a humor magazine could present a fictional story, but it has very real world implications, and it's meant to satirize something that is nonfiction.
Right.
So is there a distinction there? Are you, because this, the book particularly is looking at war. So do you have to make that distinction between something that may be presented as fiction, but really is based on a nonfiction event?
Right. That's a great question. So what interests me is work that conceives of itself as nonfictional or as documentary. So I think in this book, I'm less interested in sort of drawing a line in the sand between fiction and nonfiction from without. And Art Spiegelman, who's one of the cartoonists who I write about extensively, has said that some of the best, most interesting work happens in the space of that line. But I was interested in work that sees itself as accurate, that sees itself as reporting, that sees itself as bearing witness. That said, I have a weird kind of chapter at the beginning where I cobble together basically my version of comics history and what led to the kind of work that we see so much of today, which is this work that is bearing witness to war and disaster. And Mad is a piece of that puzzle for me. And so is really strange work that not that many people write about or talk about, like the painter Philip Guston's book on Richard Nixon called Poor Richard, which is a series of satirical drawings. Okay. So satire, I think, is a really important area because so much interesting visual and political expression is happening in satire before you get to work in the 20th century that sees itself as autobiographical or nonfiction or confessional.
And we're talking too about comic books, magazines, newspaper comics. It's the whole realm, right? It's not specific to one form of distribution.
Right. So at the risk of sounding really boring and didactic, what I explained to my students on the first day, you know, for example, a few weeks ago here at Harvard, which seems clear now, but sort of isn't if you're not used to thinking about comics the way I am, is comics is a medium. Comics, of course, like other media, contains many different genres like romance, horror, you know, reporting, what have you. And then the fascinating thing about comics is it's always been so driven by innovations in format. So we have the comic strip, we have the comic book, we have the so-called graphic novel. What does that really mean? We have sort of in-between things. If you go back to the 19th century, the person who's basically credited with creating the conventions of modern comics was a Swiss artist working in the 1830s who made what he called picture novels. So format has always been huge. And another thing that Art Spiegelman, who's a person that I've worked with closely, so I'm prone to quote his good insights, he said the history of comics in some ways is the history of printing. And so format is just really important.
Right.
What can you do in a 32-page comic book that you can't do in a four-panel comic strip in the newspaper? A lot.
And one of the things that I've found pretty cool, I was going through newspapers at one point in my archival research, and it was the same. It was the Moose Jaw Times through the 30s, and they had Little Orphan Annie.
Oh, yeah, that's such a great
So, and I was just going through each day, right? So I followed the story. And some days, as a comic strip, it wasn't very good because it was just sort of forwarding the plot. Like, oh, I'm going to go over to this person's house now. And, like, that was the day's comic. So on its own, you're like, what's the point? But when you see it in its totality, it was just laying out the story, which was really a lot of fun to see how they use the format of we have, whatever, four squares a day. And how are we going to forward this story?
Yeah, I find that so interesting. I mean, comics is so much about the serial. And sort of creating serial ways of reading. So I loved your example of the Little Orphan Annie strip. I mean, it's sort of asking readers to engage over time. In that way.
It's an investment.
It's an investment.
That you're making into the story, knowing that every day is not going to be the greatest. Like, it's not going to make you necessarily laugh every day. There's not going to be a great revelation every day. It's just the continuation of the story. Which is kind of fun.
Yeah, I think it's really fun. And it's also so different than a lot of the media that we have now. which is sort of like quick purchase on meaning, where it all seems sort of speeded up or something.
Right, and very episodic.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're even, the way they make TV shows now
is... Right, like binging on TV.
quickly digestible. There might be a serial within that thing, but, you know, and within 10 episodes.
Right.
And then that's it. Like,
right.
We're done with it. And there's not that long-term continuation.
Right, like the plot is told based on serial form.
Yeah.
But you can consume it, basically, not serially the way you would if you're... following a story in the paper, or even following a comic book that comes out every few months,
right.
And you actually have to wait.
Right. Yeah. It's very much instantaneous and episodic in its format and its distribution. And so our consumption, so the consumption pattern
right.
is much different.
Much different.
Yeah. So with respect to this book, you are talking about war specifically and the representations of war. Now, I'm wondering why you chose war for these representations when, to me... comics are much more politically motivated in their satire, in their commentary.
So, I guess one of the big distinctions for me, since we were talking about taxonomies and format and that type of thing, is the cartoon versus the comics narrative or the graphic narrative. So I often use the phrase graphic narrative instead of graphic novel because I focus on nonfiction work.
Right.
And graphic novel can sometimes be a misnomer.
Right, it implies fiction.
Right, it implies fiction. So to the extent that it implies fiction, I tend to go with graphic narrative. But, you know, it's sort of fun studying comics because the lexicon is still sort of up in the air and not codified yet. But most people... conventionally think of a cartoon as a single panel image and comics, the medium, as a form that involves sequence. So two panels. Anything where there's causality, you know, A to B. So when I think of political cartooning and that, and that really rich tradition and caricature, I tend to think of the single panel image. Of course, you have a lot of political work and satire work in comics too. But I think the fact of storytelling in comics form about war, so in sort of longer series of images, is what really got me interested in comics and war.
And you're looking at the 20th century as well, right?
Yep.
So are you jumping from wartime to wartime? Or are you looking at interwar period as well, and perhaps the way in which the memories are also being reflected and changing through time? Or is it a jumping from, say, First World War, Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, and so on?
That's a great question. So part of the structure of the book is I actually start in the 17th century. So I start with Jacques Callot, the printmaker who did the series called The Grand Miseries of War, about the 30 Years' War. And this was a series of prints that came out in 1633. So I end with the current moment, and the current moment for me was last year writing a coda about the Charlie Hebdo attacks.
Okay, yeah.
So that's as current as the book gets.
Right.
But I sort of end with the political, cultural, aesthetic position of contemporary comics, and that's my reference point. But I wanted to try to offer a longer trajectory earlier than the 20th century than people might be used to having for comics.
Okay.
So print was my big factor in deciding where to start the book. I have friends who are classics professors here at Harvard, for example, who pointed out to me, okay, well, if you're looking at narrative series of images about war, what about attic vases? You know, so if narrative and war and images, if those are your criteria, cave paintings, you can go back as far as you possibly want to, basically. But what I was really interested in, and this goes back to sort of your question about serial reading and print and this type of thing, is print and circulation. Because part of what's so powerful for me about comics as a form is how experimental it can be, how forceful it can be, especially around violent images, and then how invested it is as a form in accessibility and circulation, and how it conceives of itself as a sort of democratic art form.
Right.
So I'm not trying to claim that this person, Jacques Callot, working in the 1630s, saw himself as a cartoonist. Mm-hmm. What I'm rather trying to claim is his work, which had words and images, which was a series of engravings in which he privately printed and circulated, is an important antecedent because it sort of sets a visual grammar and a visual example for that kind of work to take shape in the centuries after. Hmm. So Goya was directly influenced by Callot when he did The Disasters of War in the 1810s, and Goya influenced plenty of contemporary cartoonists, even the ones who are working today.
Hmm. So in tracing that development, there's so many changes then through time,
right,
that go beyond maybe just the format, but also, you know, distribution and the scale,
right,
of the comics and audience and things like that. So how do you find a narrative voice within that to sort of encompass it all, to make it digestible to the reader?
I think what was really powerful to me about the examples that I put together, that I, you know, grouped together, is they were all formally experimental. They all are about witnessing. Mm-hmm. So these are works that don't just show an image of war, but somehow thematize the act of looking at images of war. So mm-hmm. they're all sort of formally self-reflexive works, and they're all interested in existing not just for private consumption or not just to be a single object that hangs on the wall.
Mm.
So that's basically the definition, in a sense, of contemporary comics,
right?
Which is awkward now that museums are getting really interested in comics. But, you know, Goya was the court artist. He did this other work on his own time and had it printed. So he specifically wanted to do this work as work that would be printed and circulated.
Hmm. And then there'd be a distinction, too, between, say, a newspaper print piece versus a book itself, or even the longer novel-y type thing. And does that shape the understanding of it? Because they're all the same medium as a comic, but within those forms, they represent different media at
right.
the same time, right? So how do we reconcile those differences?
Well, one of the things that I've always found I know, like, appealing and unpretentious about comics as a form is that you see this really experimental work happening in formats that are pretty conventional, like the newspaper.
Right.
I find it so moving that someone like Winsor McKay, who's part of my sort of prehistory in the 20th century, at least, of formally experimental work, did such beautiful work in newspapers in the early 1900s that were then used as fish wrap.
Right.
This was totally ephemeral newsprint. Mm. And he did this sort of, to me, heartbreakingly beautiful and fascinating work. Mm. So that contradiction is, again, part of what I was calling the productive awkwardness of comics that yeah. I kind of enjoy.
Now, one of the key tenets of the book is your contention that comics are more powerful or more striking images than actual photographs. Particularly in terms of commenting on wars. And I haven't studied this, so I certainly can't say for sure. I mean, I have a couple ideas as to why that would be, particularly coming out of the American Civil War, when a lot of photographers were shown to have manipulated the images and staged images, particularly of dead bodies, to get...
Like Matthew Brady type
of thing. Yeah, yeah, like to get the set... Like they had... They knew what they wanted to convey, and they set up an image to create that, but presented it as an accurate reflection of what actually happened. They just came upon the scene and took a photograph of it. So, to me, there's almost a distrust of photographers that are purporting to be authentic documentary people, like that they're getting an accurate... They're
yep.
accurately showing what happened.
Yep.
Whereas someone who's drawing a comic... doesn't have that concern. It's clear just from what they're doing that this is an interpretive
yes.
thing, right? So to me, for the reader, it could be more authentic or like it's not, there's not a risk of lying in there because it's clear what's happening just in its form.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's sort of my theory on why comics would be more striking, but
I like that theory.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think of comics as a patently artificial form, which isn't to say that it's a form that can't be accurate, but it's a form that consists of little drawn boxes sitting next to each other on a printed page, right? So it's not pretending to be transparent the way I feel like a lot of photography pretends to be transparent.
Right.
And so I think this is one of the powerful features of a form that involves drawing. And so you and I might say, oh, obviously a photograph isn't necessarily capital T true, right? Regardless of if it's actually been manipulated and composed, right? There's still all sorts of other ways where it fails to be true, right?
Sure.
It's like the saying that you take a photograph, but you make a picture.
Right.
So people think of photographs as just capturing something that's out there that's true to be captured, right? And it's true. A photograph has a different indexical relationship to what we think of as reality, as a mark on a page does. But it's not necessarily true, and it's certainly not necessarily objective.
Sure.
Right? So both comics and photography involves frames. Yet comics involves a bunch of frames that sit next to each other, sort of calling attention to itself as a form that's constituted by frames, right?
Right.
Whereas that type of thing tends to be erased in photography, like the take a picture versus, you know, make a picture distinction.
Right.
So I think that, I think like you said, because comics doesn't pretend to be capturing optical reality,
right,
the way photographs are often received as doing, it opens up a whole different area for thinking about what's accurate. And that often has to do with emotional accuracy, and it often has to do with the idea of, and this is where I sort of get to witnessing, which is one of the big themes of the book. I think you use the word authentic. The idea that a body made this mark, right?
Right.
It's not necessarily mechanical objectivity, the way we think of a camera being.
Right.
It's a body in time and space that made this mark that you're seeing in time and space. And so there's some kind of intimacy to drawing that can be absent from photography that I think can be very powerful when what's happening is witnessing violence, for example.
And I also think that comics can be more subtle.
Yeah.
Or more, I don't know what the right word is, but like there's more to them because, especially with war photographs, it's either condemning the violence and it's a horrible experience, or it's glorifying the heroes of a war, right? And there's not a lot of room in the middle. Whereas comics can get into the subtlety, can get into the nuance of war in a way that photographs, I don't think, can.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the big interlocutors for me writing this book was Susan Sontag. And, you know, she's this famous critic of photography who basically hates photography. And her very last book, which was published posthumously, called Regarding the Pain of Others, is a book that had a big influence on my thinking in writing Disaster Drawn. And what I love is that basically Regarding the Pain of Others is a history of images of atrocity that's basically about photography. And she doesn't have a single nice thing to say about any photographers or photographs until she gets to Goya, right? Who wasn't a photographer, right, yeah. You know, sort of like 50 pages into the book. So part of what she's saying in this book, which is largely about war photography, is what you were just saying. There's something about the drawn line that's actually sort of more an invitation to more engagement than a photograph often is, which are, photographs are often read as polemical, or they feel polemical.
Right.
In a way that drawings can avoid.
Now, in acknowledging that these are, you know, marks on paper, that there is the interpretive element just in the nature of what they are, who are the people who are making them? I mean, you mentioned some of the names already, but in general, the people who are creating the comics, are they people who are trying to, or who are drawing to achieve a political purpose? Or is it merely their personal expression that they want to get out? Or is it even simply a case of economics, that someone has hired them to do a comic strip and to present this narrative?
Well, that certainly is happening more and more these days as comics is entering the mainstream, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. So, right, I don't want to overly romanticize comics. I think some people are doing it for money, right?
Yeah.
But by and large, I don't think comics is a career that one would enter if one is really trying to make a lot of money. I think it's sort of like backbreaking labor and generally not a lot of recognition.
Right.
So I would say that part of what interests me about the work in this book is how it's maybe a little bit off to the side of what we would think of as capital P political. And it's also maybe a little bit off to the side of what we would think of as sort of solely personal, right? So it's work that's public and private at the same time.
Right.
So, you know, Art Spiegelman, the cartoonist who did Mouse, is doing a lot of research about World War II and the Holocaust to produce Mouse, which he worked on for 13 years. Mm-hmm. But it's also research that has the framework of being about his father and his family's experience. So both of his parents were in concentration camps in World War II, and his mother committed suicide when he was 20. Mm. And so Mouse is about him trying to elicit his father's testimony. So it's personal and it's public. It's private and it's historical. It sort of takes place right on that fault line. Someone like Joe Sacco, though, who is a comics journalist, I think sees himself as a journalist. He's doing reporting. It's not political in that it's not necessarily advocating for a certain political result or a certain political cause, but it's inescapably in the realm of the political.
Right.
So he did a book, and it's simply called Palestine. And I have an image from one of his Palestine comic books, because it was published as a standard comic book before it was collected as a book, in my introduction. So a book simply called Palestine cannot be read as anything other than political in our contemporary moment. But he's not advocating for a piece of legislation. He's not advocating for new peace talks. He's clearly invested in people on the ground. So he interviewed about 100 people on both sides of the conflict for this book. But he's making it clear that he's interested in the Palestinian perspective, right?
Right.
Hence his title.
Yeah.
Yet it's not about human rights, for example. It's doing something else that I think is even more powerful. Mm-hmm. It's sort of about his experience of being haunted by the other, of being sort of like haunted by these Palestinians that he meets and talks to and stays with and interacts with. It's not about a certain goal-oriented piece of politics. So that, to me, is where it becomes literary. It's reporting, but it's not sort of just political journalism.
So it's not like, I mean, because we think of artists, not just visual artists, like all artists, musicians, actors, all this, as being very small L liberal, and in times of war, protesting through their art. So with comics, is it fair to say then, based on that answer, that we're not seeing that to the same extent? That sure, those people would exist within the comics world, but it might not be as much of a trend as, say, in music, where all sorts of anti-war songs come out all the time.
That's such an interesting question. I think it's really evolved. So underground comics, which was a publishing and an aesthetic revolution that happened in the late 60s, was really tied to the left-wing counterculture press, you know, which was deeply involved in protesting the Vietnam War. So we have that part of comics. And underground comics, you know, is where we get people like Robert Crumb, where we get cartoonists like Art Spiegelman emerging, other people who today have really created hugely innovative books for the contemporary comics and graphic novel field. But I think, well, there's so much interesting visual anti-war propaganda, even in this period, comics was a little bit off to the side. So there's some comics directly about the Vietnam War that are like protest comics. And I think that comics during that era was a space where those anti-war feelings could be expressed safely in a way they couldn't in other venues as easily, except for, as you mentioned, music, for example, maybe poetry. But it was sort of like a fertile area for expressing what couldn't be expressed elsewhere.
Right.
But a lot of comics were inspired by Vietnam, but not directly about Vietnam.
Okay.
So this sense of like life and death urgency that was created by the Vietnam War basically created the genre of confessional comics in the early 70s. But they were confessional comics about World War II.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know, my parents survived or didn't survive the Holocaust, or they were confessional comics about sexuality.
Right.
So Vietnam is this big instigator, but it doesn't always get reflected directly in the work as a reference.
Well, is that sort of part to, like you mentioned music, that there's a lot of, even if it's not directly anti-war music, there is anti-war genre music.
Yes.
In that sense, that works in the music industry that doesn't quite filter into the television industry, a little into the film industry, but not really into television because everything is so centralized in television. Whereas in music, it's a little more diverse, a little easier to put out a record. And in comics, perhaps even much easier to make a comic.
Right.
So is the absence of a centralized structure for both production and distribution, does that help account for some of the more diverse voices that get in?
Absolutely. So, I mean, underground comics had no mainstream systems of distribution. They were published by individuals or by collectives, printed by individuals or by collectives, and distributed through non-traditional channels like at head shops. That genre that doesn't really exist anymore. You know, countercultural boutiques. Like in San Francisco on, you know, Haight Street. You know, along with bongs and other things like that. Or they were sold directly. Robert Crumb sold the first issue of Zap Comics out of a baby carriage on Haight Street. So I think the fact that there was no centralized mechanism for creating, producing, and distributing comics absolutely shaped it to be an area where people could express things that weren't able to be expressed on TV. And so I think a lot of underground comics are actually a reaction to the kind of televisual oversaturation created by the Vietnam War and covering the war.
Right. Now, I guess the problem with that is that with television, it's a little easier to tell who's watching because there's three channels.
Yeah.
And you kind of can get a sense of who's watching. With something like this where the distribution is so varied, notions of audience are very difficult to conceptualize.
Yeah.
So how for the artists themselves who are putting forth these comics, is that something they were conscious of, their audiences? Or was it more, like you say, a personal expression, particularly these confessional type comics? Or were they trying to cater to a specific audience?
That's a really interesting question. So I think that what was so powerful about underground comics was that underground comics sort of was having a high modernist moment in the late 1960s. So all of this kind of formal experimentation had been happening in other forms, you know, in the 20s, for example. But that kind of work outside of commercial constraint wasn't really available to cartoonists until underground comics.
Right.
So I think part of it was, okay, I'm creating the work that I always wanted to create and not even thinking about the audience. But because comics is a democratic art form, in my opinion, these cartoonists were also interested in creating work that would circulate. So Funny Aminals is the name of an underground comic book where Art Spiegelman first published a 3-page version of Mouse in 1972. And that had a print run of about, it's funny with underground comics because like even people who are there can't remember, 20 to 30,000. That's big. Yeah. That's big in my mind. So it wasn't just that they were creating work for other, you know, San Francisco counterculture people or New York counterculture people. You know, they wanted this work to get to people outside of this esoteric world of comics.
Right. It's not, they're not just preaching to the choir, as it
were.
Right.
They were trying not to.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And they're trying to bridge a divide with people who might not have access to what they were producing otherwise, or might not have access to those messages.
Absolutely. I mean, so this is the sort of paradox of comics that I find so interesting. They're either accused of being too much of a mass medium or being too esoteric.
Right.
Yeah. Right? And underground comics is where those two sort of meet.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, when you say underground comics, of course, it's the immediate thought goes to, you know, subversive and very different sort of thing. And we mentioned that, you know, stuff in the 1950s, and that's a time with McCarthyism, and there are hearings looking into the comic industry, and there are censorship laws in place in the 1950s. So just in general, because around war, particularly the First and Second World Wars, pop culture isn't really critical of those conflicts. A little bit in Korea, much more during Vietnam. Are comics viewed as dangerous by those in power to, or perhaps even conflicting with the official national aims of a war?
Well, you know, that's such an interesting question because I feel like in Korea, for example, Harvey Kurtzman, who started Mad Magazine, also did an incredible series called Two-Fisted Tales, in which he did very realistically drawn war comics about, for example, the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And he even did one of the first comics about the Second World War that took on the subject position of a Japanese person on the ground, I think in Nagasaki, as part of the framework of the story.
Hmm.
But I feel like at least in the 50s, comics weren't yet taken seriously enough by anyone in power for that to be an area that would be censored for that kind of content. So looking back now at cultural production around, you know, the American bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I look at a comic like that is from a Japanese civilian's point of view, and I find it really powerful.
Right.
But I don't think it elicited any censorship at the time. I think because, like you mentioned earlier, comics were seen as sort of trashy for kids type of stuff.
Right. And then moving forward, like, does the McCarthyism era change the content at all? Do comics change based on censorship laws? Or does that, sort of in the way Prohibition ironically pushed, or some people argue, push people to drink, does censorship push more people to comics and highlight that they can be a place to get a counterculture message?
Yes, although it's, you know, it's interesting that you're bringing up McCarthy. So I think for people in the comics industry, the I'm sure McCarthy was a bad guy, as he ought to have been to everybody. But one of the really bad guys was this psychiatrist, Dr. Frederick Wortham, who wrote a book called Seduction of the Innocent. And that book came out in 1954. And it was a book that laid down the argument for a link between comics and juvenile delinquency.
Mm.
And so that was the book that actually inspired the Senate hearings that led to the creation of a comics code, censorship code for comics.
Right.
So I think that was really the censoring moment that led people to so-called, you know, go underground.
Mm-hmm.
Because they actually couldn't publish interesting work in above-ground comics, or they couldn't publish that much interesting work. So part of the reason that Mad Comics became Mad Magazine was to evade this comics code.
Again, the subversive nature of the medium.
Right. And there were, I read somewhere, there were 36 FBI files on Matt. I mean, I don't think you actually needed to do much to get an FBI file. Right, you know, people were paying some attention. But I think a lot of people went sort of the underground route. Mm-hmm. I think they may have had a career in mind in so-called above ground comics. But the comics code had so many ridiculous tenets. One was, in every instance, shall good triumph over evil. I mean, it was a very reactionary, very post-war, very scared, very aesthetically death knell defying type of code.
Right.
So I think that did push people towards underground comics.
Hmm. And do you see an expansion of comics because of that not only are maybe more people going to that, but the audience is seeking it out and sort of wondering, you know, oh my God, like, if this is this bad, it must be good, sort of idea?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that going on. I mean, I also think that underground comics conceived of itself with that kind of push as being capital T taboo. So stuff was happening in comics that really wasn't happening elsewhere. Like, even, for example, images of sex.
Right.
You could buy comic books in head shops that had images of sex that you couldn't really see in movies and you couldn't really see in photographs as easily. Right. I think the fact that it was drawn got a lot of stuff under the radar and out into the world. So I think comics came to be seen as an area for visualizing the taboo.
Right. Right. Now, as we sort of move through the 20th century and then into the 21st century, you mentioned earlier that the book kind of ends with Charlie Hebdo and what happened there. There seems to me to be an interesting dynamic with comics, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but that with the rise of the graphic novel, that comics perhaps are at an all-time high in terms of mainstream popularity. Yet at the same time, the decrease in actual drawn images that we've seen, the rise of computer animation, maybe makes them not as prevalent, or that some of the meaning is taken away when they're done on a computer versus hand-drawn. So there's this weird dynamic at play that people want to consume comics, yet fewer people are actually drawing them, and maybe in their truest form. And and it strikes me that, you know, as we move forward, because drawing things takes a long time and it's expensive when you're paying people to do it. So people go to the computers, and I think you can usually notice a computer-generated image versus a hand-drawn one, and there's so much power in a hand-drawn one. So I'm just wondering if there's some sort of breaking point where we have to resolve some sort of tension between the form of comics and their popularity.
Yeah, I think there are a couple things to say there, and one is that I've thought about this a lot. Part of what I love about comics is what Aileen Kaminsky Crumb, who's a cartoonist who created the first autobiographical comics by a woman in the United States in the early 70s. She called it a dinosaur medium.
Okay.
You know, and she described, like, you're sweating on the page, like food gets on the page, it's pen and ink, you're scratching your drawings into the page. There's something very tactile about the act of creating comics with, you know, ink and paper. But I also know a lot of cartoonists whose work I really admire who now create comics on a tablet. So they're drawing. It's still a motion with the hand, but it's on a digital tablet as opposed to on Bristol board.
Right.
For example. So it might not be the same kind of mark, and to me the issue is kind of aesthetic. I love marks in which I can sort of see a grain, in marks that seem expressive. Some of those marks might not be as easily replicated on a digital tablet, but there is something about the sort of like kinesthetic hand implement motion that isn't like using stock art to create a comic.
Right.
And there are comics that do that, yeah. Right? There are a bunch of web comics that do that. So I tend to prefer work that isn't born digital, mm-hmm. but plenty of people think that print is a fetish. Mm. And Scott McCloud, who's sort of one of the famous comics theorists who did the book Understanding Comics, which is a book about comics theory in the form of comics, told me print is a fetish.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That said, sort of so the other part of this answer is that whether or not it's a fetish, I think that comics are powerful because of their stubborn tie to print culture. Mm. So something like Chris Ware's Building Stories, which came out in 2012 and is a big 11-inch by 17-inch by 2-inch box that has 14 different comics inside it. It's a book in a box. Uh-huh. It's sort of like a manifesto for print culture.
Right.
It sold out its first run at Pantheon, which is published by Random House. So comics is in a way saving the idea of the book as object today. Most comics can't be reflowed for digital devices, for example, the way most novels can.
Sure.
Like Ulysses is Ulysses is Ulysses, basically, whether you're reading it in hard copy or on the Kindle.
Yep.
A book like Chris Ware's Building Stories cannot exist on the Kindle.
Right.
Because it's an object that exists in space and has dimension in a different way.
Right. So it's kind of interesting then that because the physical product is so important that even though the barrier to entry might seem lower because people can do it digitally, maybe it's not as marketable that way. And so ironically, the digital and the expansion of the digital has made the original more valuable, or the physical more valuable, which is very much the opposite of what is happening in other forms of media.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And, you know, there's some great webcomics.
As it starts to pour.
As things are crashing out the window.
Yeah.
One of my favorite cartoonists who works on the web is Kate Beaton, who's Canadian, and she actually has a bunch of funny comics about Canada. Have you heard of her?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you would... Well, I'm guessing. I'm hoping you would love it. So her comic strip is called Harka Vagrant, and it's online. But the way most people who work on the web actually get money to make a living is by then collecting their web comics as a printed volume.
Really?
So economically, not a lot of web comics, even popular ones like Kate Beaton's, are viable simply on the web. There's still this tie to print culture. But the exciting part of it is that it's kind of like the underground comics of the 21st century.
Right?
It's easily, as you were mentioning, publishable and distributable. Yeah. So, you know, you can do your little web comic at home and slap it up there that night.
Right.
And get a response from your community of readers. And I think there is something powerful about that.
So let's just promote the book again, because I could try to unpack some of this stuff all day. It's Disaster Drawn, Visual Witness, Comics and Documentary Form, and it's available through the University of Harvard Press. Hardcover now, paperback hopefully. forthcoming?
Yeah, I hope so.
And for an academic publisher, it's not expensive. Within the context of academic publishing.
Right, it doesn't cost $120. Yes. So it's not only for libraries, I hope. Although I hope the libraries buy it too.
Yes. Yeah. And presumably there's a lot of... It's not just text in there. You'd have a lot of images. And
I have 60-something images printed in full color.
Yeah,
I know it's quite dorky to brag about stuff like that. Hey, color images. But it's hard to get... it's hard with academic publishing and the subject because there aren't a lot of examples.
Right.
It's not like publishing an art history book, and it's not like publishing a book that's just prose criticism. Mm-hmm. Somewhere in between.
Right, and especially with stuff that was ephemeral, as you said. You know, where do you find it?
Right. Sort of.
So images, and it really sounds like a terrific book. All of the reviews and stuff that I've read have been very positive about it, so sounds like a great read
Thank you.
I look forward to getting into now that it has been officially launched.
Thank you.
By the press. So Hillary Shute, visiting professor in the Department of English here at Harvard, regularly a faculty member at the University of Chicago. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you very much.
If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, it's historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.